Life under Trump, however, did not resemble life in Joseph Addison's eponymous Cato, where the hero strove to defend the failing Roman Republic against Julius Caesar. Instead, the new administration resembled much more closely the Eagles song Hotel California. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. It was not long before Bannon and Priebus were again calling and texting me to come into the White House in some capacity, as they sought to overcome the mismatches between Trump, McMaster, and Tillerson. The most palpable manifestation of the problems was Iran, specifically the 2015 nuclear deal, which Obama considered a crowning achievement, the other being Obamacare. The deal was badly conceived, abominably negotiated and drafted, and entirely advantageous to Iran, unenforceable, unverifiable, and inadequate in duration and scope. Although purportedly resolving the threat posed by Iran's nuclear weapons program, the deal did no such thing. In fact, it exacerbated the threat by creating the semblance of a solution, diverting attention from the dangers and lifting the economic sanctions that had imposed substantial pain on Iran's economy while allowing Tehran to proceed essentially unimpeded. Moreover, the deal did not seriously address other threats Iran posed: its ballistic missile program, a thinly disguised effort to develop delivery vehicles for nuclear weapons, its continuing role as the world's central banker for international terrorism, and its other malign activity in the region through the intervention and growing strength of the Quds Force, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps' external military arm in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and elsewhere. Freed from sanctions, benefiting from the transfer of $150 million in cash on pallets, in cargo airplanes, and the unfreezing of an estimated $150 billion in assets globally, Tehran's radical Ayatollahs were back in business. Trump and other 2016 GOP candidates campaigned against the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the lumbering formal title of the Iran deal, and it was widely believed to be ready for extreme unction following his inauguration. But a combination of Tillerson, Mattis, and McMaster frustrated Trump's efforts to break free from this wretched deal, earning them the plaudits of the adoring media as an axis of adults restraining Trump from indulging in wild fantasies. If only they knew. In fact, many of Trump's supporters saw their efforts as preventing him from doing what he had promised voters he would do. And McMaster wasn't doing himself any favors by opposing the phrase radical Islamic terrorism to describe things like radical Islamic terrorism. Jim Baker used to tell me when I worked for him at Bush 41's State Department and pressed for something Baker knew Bush didn't want, "John, the guy who got elected doesn't want to do it." That was usually a signal I should stop pushing. But in the Trump administration's infant national security apparatus, what "the guy who got elected" wanted was only one of many data points. In early May, after I had another White House discussion with Priebus and Bannon, they took me to what turned out to be a photo opportunity with Trump and Pence in the colonnade that connects the residence to the West Wing. "John, so good to see you," said Trump, as we walked along the colonnade, surrounded by photographers. We talked about the Philippines and the Chinese threat to bring nearly the entire South China Sea under its sovereignty. When we finished, Trump said loud enough for the trailing mob of reporters to hear, "Is Rex Tillerson around? He should talk to John." And with that, Trump was off to the Oval. Priebus said, "That was great. We want to get you back over here regularly." Life at the White House developed its own rhythm, with Trump firing FBI Director James Comey later in May, at Kushner's suggestion, according to Bannon, then meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, whom I had known for over 25 years at that point, and allegedly being less than cautious in discussing classified material, calling Comey a nut job, according to the unbiased New York Times. I was in Israel in late May to give a speech and met with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, whom I had first met in the Bush 41 years. Iran's threat was the centerpiece of our attention, as it should have been for any Israeli prime minister, but he was also dubious about assigning the task of bringing an end to the Israel-Palestinian conflict to Kushner, whose family Netanyahu had known for many years. He was enough of a politician not to oppose the idea publicly, but like much of the world, he wondered why Kushner thought he would succeed where the likes of Kissinger had failed. I was back at the White House in June to see Trump, walking with Priebus to the outer oval. Trump saw us through his open door and said, "Hi, John, give me just a minute. I'm signing judges' commissions." I was happy to give him all the time he needed, because Trump's growing record on judicial nominations, in due course to be graced by the confirmation of Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, was, for conservatives, the highest priority and greatest achievement of his tenure. When Priebus and I entered, I congratulated Trump on withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement, which the Axis of Adults had failed to stop him from doing, and which I saw as an important victory against global governance. The Paris Agreement was a charade for those truly concerned about climate change. As in many other cases, international agreements provided the semblance of addressing major issues, giving national politicians something to take credit for, but made no discernible real-world difference, in this case, giving leeway to countries like China and India, which remained essentially unfettered. I gave Trump a copy of a 2000 article of mine called "Should We Take Global Governance Seriously?" from the Chicago Journal of International Law, not because I thought he would read it, but to remind him of the importance of preserving U.S. sovereignty. I warned Trump against wasting political capital in an elusive search to solve the Arab-Israeli dispute and strongly supported moving the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, thereby recognizing it as Israel's capital. On Iran, I urged that he press ahead to withdraw from the nuclear agreement and explained why the use of force against Iran's nuclear program might be the only lasting solution. "You tell Bibi that if he uses force, I will back him." "I told him that, but you tell him again," Trump said, unprompted by me. As the conversation ranged on, Trump asked, "Do you get along with Tillerson?" And I said we hadn't spoken since January. Bannon told me a few days later that Trump was pleased with the meeting, and indeed, a few weeks on, Tillerson called to ask me to be special envoy for Libyan reconciliations, which I saw as another exercise in box-checking. If asked, Tillerson could tell Trump he had offered me something, but I turned it down. Tillerson almost simultaneously asked Kurt Volker, a close associate of McCain's, to become special envoy for Ukraine. Neither job required full-time government employment, but my view was you were either in the administration or not, and halfway houses wouldn't work. North Korea was also on the administration's mind with the release of Otto Warmbier, who suffered barbaric treatment at Pyongyang's hands and died upon returning to the United States. The North's brutality told us everything we needed to know about its regime. Moreover, Pyongyang was launching ballistic missiles, including on the 4th of July, how thoughtful, followed by another on July 28th, which ultimately led to further UN Security Council sanctions on August 5th. A few days later, Trump was prompted to threaten fire and fury like the world has never seen against North Korea, though Tillerson immediately said Americans should sleep well at night and have no concern about this particular rhetoric of the past few days, hardly clarifying things. I wondered if Tillerson was poo-pooing North Korea or Trump, who upped the ante on August 11th by saying the U.S. was locked and loaded on North Korea. There was little visible evidence that any new military preparations were underway. On August 30th, Trump tweeted that we had talked to North Korea for 25 years without result, and there wasn't much point in talking further. Trump reiterated the point on October 7th. Presidents and their administrations have been talking to North Korea for 25 years. Agreements made and massive amounts of money paid. Hasn't worked. Agreements violated before the ink was dry, making fools of U.S. negotiators. Sorry, but only one thing will work. Mattis, in South Korea, almost immediately contradicted Trump, saying there was always room for diplomacy, although he quickly walked it back, claiming there was no daylight between him and the president. The dissonance was getting louder. North Korea had chimed in with its sixth nuclear weapons test on September 3rd, this one almost certainly thermonuclear, followed 12 days later by firing a missile over Japan, underlining Trump's point in his tweet. Almost immediately thereafter, Japanese Prime Minister Abe wrote a New York Times op-ed concluding that more dialogue with North Korea would be a dead end, and saying, "I fully support the United States' position that all options are on the table," which is as close as any Japanese politician can get to saying he could support offensive military operations. By contrast, Tillerson was announcing we wanted to bring North Korea to the table for constructive, productive dialogue. He was obviously deep in the grip of the building. When Trump announced new financial sanctions on North Korea, China responded by saying its central bank had directed all Chinese banks to cease doing business with Pyongyang, which was quite a step forward if actually carried out, and many were dubious. Iran remained the most visible flashpoint, however, and in July, Trump faced his second decision whether to certify Iran was complying with the nuclear deal. The first decision to do so had been a mistake, and now Trump was on the verge of repeating it. I wrote an op-ed for The Hill that appeared on its website on July 16th, apparently setting off a day-long battle inside the White House. McMaster and Mnuchin held a conference call to brief reporters on the decision to certify Iranian compliance, and the White House emailed talking points to the media explaining the decision as their call was underway. But an outside analyst told me, "There's chaos at the NSC. The talking points were pulled back, and the decision to certify compliance was reversed. The New York Times, citing a White House official, reported on a nearly hour-long confrontation between Trump on one side and Mattis, Tillerson, and McMaster on the other on the certification issue, confirming what I had heard earlier. Other sources said the same thing. Trump ultimately succumbed, but not happily, and only after yet again asking for alternatives, of which his advisors said there were none. Bannon texted me, "POTUS loved it. Your op-ed drove him on Iran." Trump called me a few days later to complain about how the Iran certification issue had been handled, and especially about people in the State Department who hadn't given him any options. Then he said, referring to my last conversation with Tillerson, "I hear what Rex talked to you about won't work. Don't take some half-assed position over there. If he offers you something that's really great, okay, whatever, but otherwise just wait. I'm going to call you," concluding the call by saying I should come and see him next week on Iran. Bannon texted me right afterward, "We talk about it, you, every day." I told Bannon I would write a plan about how the U.S. could withdraw from the Iran deal. It would not be hard. The next day, Sean Spicer resigned as White House spokesman to protest Anthony Scaramucci's being named communications director, with Sarah Sanders picked as Spicer's successor. 1 week later, Trump fired Priebus, naming John Kelly, then Homeland Security Secretary and a former four-star Marine general, as White House Chief of Staff. On Monday, July 31st, Kelly fired Scaramucci. In mid-August, controversy erupted over Trump's comments about neo-Nazi demonstrators in Charlottesville, Virginia. He fired Bannon on August 18th. Was this what business schools taught about running large organizations? What was not happening was any White House sign of life on my Iran deal exit strategy, which I had earlier transmitted to Bannon. When I sought a meeting with Trump, Westerhout suggested I first see Tillerson, which would have been a waste of time for both of us. I suspected that Kelly's efforts to bring discipline to White House operations and limit Oval Office anarchy in particular had resulted in my walk-in privileges being suspended, along with those of many others. I thought it would be a shame to let my Iran plan wither, so I suggested to National Review editor Rich Lowry that he publish it, which he did at the end of August. Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif immediately denounced my plan as a huge failure for Washington. I knew I was on the right track. Most of the Washington media, instead of focusing on the plan's substance, wrote instead on my loss of access to Trump, probably because they understood palace intrigue better than policy. Kushner texted me to say, "You're always welcome at the White House," and "Steve Bannon and I disagreed on many things, but we were in sync on Iran." In fact, Kushner invited me to meet on August 31st to go over his emerging Middle East peace plan along with Iran. After a relatively long hiatus, I didn't think this meeting was accidental. Nonetheless, still no word from Trump, although another Iran compliance certification required every 90 days by statute came due in October. The White House announced Trump would make a major Iran address on October 12th, so I decided to stop being shy, phoning Westerhout to ask for a meeting. By then, Tillerson had reportedly called Trump a fucking moron, which he refused to deny flatly. Rumors flew that Kelly wanted to resign as chief of staff and that Pompeo would replace him, although it was also regularly rumored that Pompeo would replace McMaster. I was still focused on Iran and wrote another op-ed for The Hill, hoping the magic might work again. It appeared on October 9th, the same day I had lunch with Kushner in his West Wing office. Although we talked about his Middle East peace plan and Iran, what really got his attention was the photo I brought of the gaudy entrance to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office, located in the building where my super PAC was located. The media reported Trump's advisors were urging he decline to certify Iran as complying with the nuclear agreement, but that the U.S. nonetheless stay in the deal. I saw this as self-humiliation, but so desperate were the deal's advocates that they were willing to concede a critical point on compliance just to save the deal. Trump called me in the late afternoon of October 12th, the speech having been moved to Friday the 13th, to talk. "You and I are together on that deal. You may be a little tougher than I am, but we see it the same," he said. I answered that I could see from the press coverage he was likely to decertify Iran but still remain in the deal, which I said was at least a step forward. I asked to discuss the issue further when there was more time. 100%, said Trump. 100%. I know that's your view. I watch what you say very carefully. I asked if he would put a line in his speech that the agreement was under 24/7 review, and that it was subject to being terminated at any time, thus eliminating the need to wait 90 days before having another shot at withdrawal, and plainly making the fight over withdrawal rather than compliance, as the deal's supporters preferred. We talked about the language Trump might actually use as he dictated to others in the room. Trump then raised the topic of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, asking if he should designate it as a foreign terrorist organization, thereby subjecting it to additional penalties and constraints. I urged him to do so because of the organization's control of Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile programs and its extensive support for radical Islamic terrorism, Sunni and Shia. Trump said he was hearing Iran would be particularly upset by this specific designation, and there might be blowback against U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria, which I learned later was Mattis's position. But his argument was misdirected. If Mattis was correct, the answer was to provide more protection for our troops or withdraw them to focus on the main threat, Iran. As it turned out, it would take nearly 2 years to get the Revolutionary Guard designated as a foreign terrorist organization, showing the immense staying power of a dug-in bureaucracy. Trump also said he was thinking of saying something on North Korea, which I urged him to do. On Friday, he said, "There are also many people who believe that Iran is dealing with North Korea. I'm going to instruct our intelligence agencies to do a thorough analysis and report back their findings beyond what they have already reviewed." I was delighted. I said I looked forward to talking with him again, and Trump said, "Absolutely." Later in November, on my birthday, purely coincidentally, I am sure, Trump returned the North to the list of state sponsors of terrorism from which the Bush 43 administration had mistakenly removed it. I thought the Trump call had accomplished four things. One, having the speech announce that the Iran deal was under continuous review and subject to U.S. withdrawal at any time. Two, raising the connection between Iran and North Korea. Three, making it clear the Revolutionary Guard should be designated as a foreign terrorist organization, and four, getting a renewed commitment that I could see him without other approvals. Ironically, by having me on the speakerphone, all of those points were clear to whoever was in the Oval with him. I wondered, in fact, if I could do much more if I were actually in the administration, rather than just calling in from the outside a few hours before a speech like this one. Kushner had me back to the White House on November 16th to discuss his Middle East peace plan. I urged that we withdraw from the UN Human Rights Council rather than follow Haley's plan to reform it. See Chapter 8. The Council was a sham when I voted against it in 2006, having abolished its equally worthless predecessor. We should never have rejoined as Obama did. I also advocated defunding the UN Relief and Works Agency, ostensibly designed to aid Palestinian refugees, but that over decades had become effectively an arm of the Palestine apparat rather than the UN. Kushner said twice how much better I would be handling state than present management. In early December, Trump, fulfilling a 2016 commitment, declared Jerusalem as Israel's capital and announced that he would move the U.S. embassy there. He had called me a few days before, and I'd expressed support, although he had clearly already decided to act. It was long overdue and utterly failed to produce the crisis in the Arab street regional experts had endlessly predicted. Most Arab states had shifted their attention to the real threat, which was Iran, not Israel. In January, the U.S. cut its funding for the UN Relief and Works Agency, contributing only $60 million of an expected tranche of $125 million, or roughly one-sixth of the estimated total fiscal year 2018 U.S. contribution of $400 million. Trump again invited me to the White House on December 7th. I was sitting in the West Wing lobby admiring the huge Christmas tree when Trump came in leading Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi just after a congressional leadership meeting. We all shook hands, and the various leaders began posing for pictures in front of the tree. As I was watching, John Kelly grabbed my elbow and said, "Let's get out of here and go back for our meeting." We went to the Oval, and Trump came in almost immediately along with Pence. We exchanged greetings, and then Pence departed and Kelly and I sat in front of Trump, who was behind the Resolute desk. I welcomed the embassy move to Jerusalem, and we quickly turned to Iran and North Korea. I explained some of the linkages between the two rogue states, including the North's sale of Scud missiles to Iran over 25 years ago, their joint missile testing in Iran after 1998, following Japanese protests, Pyongyang had declared a moratorium on launch testing from the peninsula after landing a projectile in the Pacific east of Japan, and their shared objective of developing delivery vehicles for nuclear weapons. On nuclear capabilities, Pakistani proliferator AQ Khan had sold both countries their basic uranium enrichment technology, which he stole for Pakistan from Europe's Urenco Limited, and nuclear weapons designs, initially provided to Pakistan by China. North Korea had been building the reactor in Syria destroyed by Israel in September 2007, almost certainly financed by Iran. And I described how Iran could simply buy what it wanted from North Korea at the appropriate time if it hadn't already. The threat of North Korea's acquiring deliverable nuclear weapons manifests itself in several ways. First, strategy depends on analyzing intentions and capabilities. Intentions are often hard to read. Capabilities are generally easier to assess, even granted that our intelligence is imperfect. But who wants to bet on what is really on the minds of the leaders in the world's only hereditary communist dictatorship in the face of hard evidence of accelerating nuclear and missile capabilities? Second, a nuclear-armed North Korea can conduct blackmail against nearby non-nuclear weapons states like Japan and South Korea, where we have large deployed forces ourselves, and even against the United States, especially under a weak or feckless president. The dangers do not come simply from the risk of a first strike, but from mere possession, not to mention the incentives for onward proliferation in East Asia and elsewhere created by a nuclear Pyongyang. Third, the North had repeatedly demonstrated it will sell anything to anybody with hard cash, so the risks of its becoming a nuclear Amazon are far from trivial. I explained why and how a preemptive strike against North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs would work, how we could use massive conventional bombs against Pyongyang's artillery north of the DMZ, which threatens Seoul, thereby reducing casualties dramatically, and why the United States was rapidly approaching a binary choice, assuming China didn't act dramatically, of either leaving the North with nuclear weapons or using military force. The only other alternatives were seeking reunification of the peninsula under South Korea or regime change in the North, both of which required cooperation with China, which we had not even begun to broach with them. Trump asked, "What do you think the chances of war are with North Korea? 50-50? I said I thought it all depended on China, but probably 50-50. Trump turned to Kelly and said, "He agrees with you." In the course of this conversation, which lasted about 35 minutes, Trump raised his dissatisfaction with Tillerson, saying he didn't seem to have control of state. Trump asked why, and I said it was because Tillerson hadn't filled the subordinate ranks with appointees who would advance the administration's policies, and that he had, in effect, been captured by the careerists. I also explained why state needed a cultural revolution because of its desire to run foreign policy on its own, especially under Republican presidents, during which both Trump and Kelly nodded affirmatively. Trump asked Kelly what he thought Tillerson was doing wrong, and Kelly said Tillerson was trying to centralize decision-making too much in his own hands. I agreed, but said delegating authority had to go hand in hand with getting the right people in place to delegate it to. Kelly agreed, saying, "Delegation with supervision." Trump then said to Kelly, "John knows that place, state, backwards and forwards." Kelly nodded agreement. I thought it was striking that Trump did not raise McMaster. As we ended the meeting, Trump said, "You're still ready to come in for the right position, am I right?" I laughed and said, "For the right position, yes." As Kelly and I walked back to the West Wing lobby, he said, "The guy loves you. After we've been here all day, he'll call me at home at 9:30 at night and say, 'Did you just see Bolton on television?'" I told Kelly to call me if I could be of help and left the building. A week before Christmas, I met again with Kushner on the Middle East peace plan for about 40 minutes and had a couple of other spare calls with him during the month. Other than that, things were quiet for the rest of the month. Happy New Year. On January 6, 2018, during a maelstrom of press commentary on the new Fire and Fury book about Trump, he tweeted that he was a very stable genius. With another statutorily required presidential decision approaching on whether to have the pre-Iran deal sanctions come back into force, I decided to sit back. They knew how to get me if they wanted to, and no one made contact. Trump reprised what he had done in October, keeping the sanctions from coming back into effect, but not certifying that Iran was complying with the deal. No progress. And then North Korea returned to the spotlight as South Korea hosted the Winter Olympics. Pence and Ivanka Trump represented the U.S. amid speculation of talks with the North Korea delegation. I gave interviews applauding Pence for not letting the North gain a propaganda edge or drive wedges between us and South Korea. Pence tweeted in response, "Well said, at Am John Bolton." A nice signal. Of course, South Korean President Moon Jae-in was going all out for domestic political purposes to highlight his success in having high-level North Koreans attend, particularly Kim Jong-un's younger sister, Kim Yo-jong, sanctioned by the U.S. as a known violator of human rights. In fact, Kim Yo-jong did have a mission, inviting Moon to the North, which he accepted instantly. It trickled out later that Seoul had paid Pyongyang's costs of participating in the Games, not from any Olympic spirit, but following a sad, well-established pattern. South Korea's left worshipped this sunshine policy, which basically held that being nice to North Korea would bring peace to the peninsula. Instead, again and again, it merely subsidized the North's dictatorship. On March 6th, I had yet another meeting with Trump. Waiting in the West Wing lobby, I watched on television as reporters asked why he thought the North was now ready to negotiate, and Trump replied happily, "Me." I hoped he understood North Korea truly feared that he, unlike Obama, was prepared, if necessary, to use military force. I went to the Oval at about 4:40, once again sitting in front of the completely clean, resolute desk. Trump said to me, just as Kelly entered, "Did I ask for this meeting, or did you?" I said I had, and he responded, "I thought I had, but I'm glad you came in, because I wanted to see you." We started off talking about North Korea, and I explained I thought Kim Jong-un was trying to buy time to finish the relatively few, albeit critical, tasks still necessary to achieve a deliverable nuclear weapons capability. That meant that Kim Jong-un now especially feared military force. He knew economic sanctions alone wouldn't prevent him from reaching that goal. I wasn't quite sure Trump got the point, but I also raised reports of North Korea's selling chemical weapons equipment and precursor chemicals to Syria, likely financed by Iran. If true, this linkage could be pivotal for both North Korea and Iran, showing just how dangerous Pyongyang was. Now selling chemical weapons, soon enough selling nuclear weapons. I urged him to use this argument to justify both exiting the Iran nuclear deal and taking a harder line on North Korea. Kelly agreed and urged me to keep pounding away in public, which I assured him I would. On the Iran nuclear deal, Trump said, "Don't worry, I'm getting out of that." I said they could try to fix it, but that won't happen. He turned to how much he wanted to fire Tillerson, saying, "You know what's wrong. I'd love to have you over there." But he said he thought confirmation with just a 51-49 Republican majority would be difficult. "That son of a bitch Rand Paul will vote against you, and McConnell is worried he may persuade other Republicans who need his vote on judges and other things. What do you hear?" I said I wouldn't get Paul's vote, but I would be surprised if he dragged other Republicans along with him. The real count in the Senate, however, increasingly looked to be 50-49 as John McCain's health continued to deteriorate, raising the prospect he might never return to Washington. I also said, based on earlier conversations with Republican senators, that we could roll up a handful of Democrats, especially in an election year. I doubted I'd persuaded Trump, and he asked, "What else would you be interested in?" I answered, "National Security Advisor." Kelly broke his silence to underline that that job did not require Senate confirmation, and Trump asked happily, "So I don't have to worry about those clowns up there?" And both Kelly and I said, "Right." I then launched into a description of what I thought the core duties of the National Security Advisor's job were, namely, ensuring that the full range of options was put before the president and that his decisions were then carried out, at which Kelly nodded vigorously. I said I thought my training as a litigator equipped me for that role because I could present the options fairly but still have my own point of view, as one does with clients, and that I understood he made the final decisions, once again telling him the Dean Acheson-Harry Truman story. Trump and Kelly both laughed. Trump asked me what I thought McMaster had done right, and I said it was a real achievement to write a good national security strategy in a president's first year in office, something that had not occurred, for example, in Bush 43's tenure, among others. Trump asked what I thought Mattis had done well, and I cited the major defense budget increase over the Obama years the administration had recently won. Before I could finish, both Trump and Kelly said simultaneously the budget win was Trump's accomplishment, not Mattis's. I thought that was a real revelation about Trump's attitude toward Mattis. The meeting ended after about 35 minutes, and Trump said, "Okay, stay patient. I'll be calling you." Kelly and I walked out of the Oval, and he asked, "Have you thought about the media reaction if you get named?" I had, saying I had been through it already when nominated to the UN ambassadorship. Kelly said, "Yes, that was outrageous. But think about it again anyway, because he's serious." I had put up with so much from the media over the years that I really didn't care what their reaction was. By that point, my scar tissue had scars. As the Duke of Wellington once said, perhaps apocryphally, my attitude was, "Print and be damned." I felt pretty good until that evening. While addressing a fundraiser in Northern Virginia for Republican Congresswoman Barbara Comstock, whom I first met at the Reagan Justice Department, I heard Kim Jong-un had invited Trump to meet, and he had accepted. I was beyond speechless, appalled at this foolish mistake. For a U.S. president to grant Kim a summit with no sign whatever of a strategic decision to renounce nuclear weapons, in fact, giving it away for nothing, was a propaganda gift beyond measure. It was worse by orders of magnitude than Madeleine Albright clinking glasses with Kim Il-sung during the Clinton years. Fortunately, I had no Fox interviews that night because of the fundraiser, so I had time to think about it. The next day, Sarah Sanders seemed to walk things back, saying our existing policy had not changed. As I had left the White House earlier on Tuesday, the White House had announced Gary Cohn's resignation as chairman of the National Economic Council. Larry Kudlow was named to replace him. In the meantime, in February, White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter resigned because of damaging personal information revealed in his FBI background investigation, followed shortly thereafter by Trump's longtime staffer Hope Hicks, then communications director. The bloodletting continued on March 13th with the announcement that Tillerson had been unceremoniously fired as Secretary of State, that Pompeo would be nominated to replace him, and that Pompeo's CIA deputy, Gina Haspel, a career intelligence officer, would succeed him. Kushner called me the next day for another meeting on his Middle East peace plan, which I again found difficult to believe was entirely coincidental. Then on March 16th, Jeff Sessions resumed the bloodletting by firing FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. Life around the world, however, was still rolling along. A Russian hit squad, using chemical weapons from the Novichok family, attacked former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Salisbury, England. After Moscow disdainfully refused even to address the attack, Prime Minister May expelled 23 undeclared Russian intelligence agents. In interviews, I took a very tough view of how America should respond to this attack, a view I still hold. So, it was unsettling to read that Trump had congratulated Putin on winning re-election as president of Russia over McMaster's advice, which had been promptly and widely leaked to the media. Nonetheless, Trump later expelled over 60 Russian diplomats as part of a NATO-wide effort to show solidarity with London. As several House members helping me with my National Security Advisor campaign confided, we were within days of Trump's deciding who would replace McMaster. I gritted my teeth because the job was looking more arduous than before, but I decided not to pull back now. On Wednesday, March 21st, my cell phone rang as I was riding down a snowy George Washington Memorial Parkway to do an interview at Fox's D.C. studio, the federal government and most area schools and businesses being closed. "Good morning, Mr. President," I said, and Trump replied, "I've got a job for you that is probably the most powerful job in the White House." As I started to answer, Trump said, "No, really, better than chief of staff." And we both laughed, which meant Kelly was probably in the room with him. "And you won't have to deal with the Democrats in the Senate. No need for that. You should come in and we'll talk about this. Come in today or tomorrow. I want someone with gravitas, not some unknown. You have great support from all kinds of people, great support, like those Freedom Caucus guys," a group of Republicans in the House. I thanked Trump, and then called my wife and daughter Gretchen and J.S., Jennifer Sarah, to tell them, stressing that for Trump, it was never over until something was publicly announced, and sometimes not then. I met with Trump in the Oval the next day at 4 o'clock. We started into what seemed like another interview, talking about Iran and North Korea. Much of what Trump said harked back to his campaign days, before a series of speeches had positioned him in the broad Republican mainstream foreign policy thinking. I wondered if he was having second thoughts about making me an offer, but at least he said unequivocally he was getting out of the Iran deal. He said almost nothing about the supposed upcoming summit with Kim Jong-un, an omission I found hard to read. The largest single block of time was spent discussing again how I thought the NSC should work. Although I didn't mention Brent Scowcroft by name, the system I explained, as Kelly well knew, was what Scowcroft had done in the Bush 41 administration. First, it was the NSC's responsibility to provide the president with the available options and the pluses and minuses of each. Second, once a decision was made, the NSC was the president's enforcer to ensure that the bureaucracies carried out the decision. All this resonated with Trump, although he didn't directly offer me the job, asking instead, "So you think you want to do this?" I was beginning to wonder if this now hour-long meeting was just going to dribble off inconclusively when Westerhout came in to tell Trump he had another meeting. He stood up, and of course, so did I. We shook hands over the Resolute desk. Although there had been no clear offer and acceptance, both Kelly and I knew what had in fact happened, in the Trumpian way. Given the experiences already recounted here and more, why accept the job? Because America faced a very dangerous international environment, and I thought I knew what needed to be done. I had strong views on a wide range of issues, developed during prior government service and private sector study. And Trump? No one could claim by this point not to know the risks in store up close, but I also believed I could handle it. Others may have failed for one reason or another, but I thought I could succeed. Was I right? Listen on. Outside the Oval, I encountered White House counsel Don McGahn going in with folders on potential judicial nominations. Kelly and I spoke for a few minutes, and I said it was clear to me that neither one of us could accomplish anything unless we worked together, which was my intention, and he readily agreed. I also asked what the timing of an announcement might be, and he thought the next day or the following week at the earliest. I later learned, as did Kelly, that within minutes of my leaving the Oval, Trump called McMaster to tell him he would be announcing the switch later that same afternoon. I went to the West Wing lobby to retrieve my coat, and the receptionist and a White House communications staffer said there was a mob of reporters and photographers waiting for me to exit the north door to the driveway. They asked if I would mind going out the back way, through the White House's southwest gate onto 17th Street and walking behind the Eisenhower Executive Office Building to miss the press, which I happily did. I called Gretchen and J.S. again and began to think about preparations for starting at the White House. On my way to the Fox News studio for an interview on Martha McCallum's show, Trump tweeted, "I am pleased to announce that effective 4/9/18, @ John Bolton will be my new national security advisor. I am very thankful for the service of General H.R. McMaster, who has done an outstanding job and will always remain my friend. There will be an official contact handover on 4/9. At that point, my cell phone felt like a hand grenade going off with incoming calls, emails, tweets, and news alerts. I now had some 2 weeks to make the necessary transition away from private life to government service, and the pace was frenetic. The next day, Trump called me during his intelligence briefing saying, "You're getting great press," that the announcement was playing very big, getting great reviews, the base loves it, and so on. He said at one point, "Some of them think you're the bad cop," and I replied, "When we play the good cop, bad cop routine, the president is always the good cop." Trump responded, "The trouble is, we've got two bad cops." And I could hear the others in the Oval for the intel briefing laughing, as was I. Since Trump had announced I would start on April 9th, the first priority was the White House counsel's vetting process. This consisted of filling out extensive forms and undergoing questioning by the counsel's office lawyers on financial disclosure issues, possible conflicts of interest, requirements for divestiture of assets, not that I had all that much to divest, unwinding existing employment relationships, freezing my PAC and super PAC during my government service, and the like. Also required was what baby boomers called the sex, drugs, and rock and roll interview, where typically the trap was not what foolish things you had done in your life, but whether you admitted them in response to questions or volunteered them if they were exotic enough. Since my last government job as UN ambassador, I had received plenty of media coverage, so I took care to mention even the outlandish things that lazy, biased, incompetent reporters had published at my expense, including that Maria Butina had tried to recruit me as a Russian agent. I do not think the press is an enemy of the people, but as Dwight Eisenhower said in 1964, its ranks are filled with sensation-seeking columnists and commentators whose writings mark them as little more than intellectualoids. Then there was the mandatory urine sample I provided for drug testing. Let's not forget that. I also tried to consult with former national security advisors, starting, of course, with Kissinger, who said, "I have great confidence in you, and I wish you every success. You know the subject. You know the bureaucracy. I know you are able to handle it." And most important, Kissinger, like every predecessor with whom I spoke, Republican and Democrat alike, offered their support. I spoke with Colin Powell, who had been my boss when he was Secretary of State in Bush 43's first term, Brent Scowcroft, James Jones, Condi Rice, Steve Hadley, Susan Rice, John Poindexter, and Bud McFarlane, as well as Bob Gates, who had been Scowcroft's deputy and later Secretary of Defense. Scowcroft said succinctly, "The world is a mess, and we're the only ones who can straighten it out." I spoke with former secretaries of state for whom I had worked, including George Shultz and Jim Baker. Powell and Condi Rice, of course, fell into both categories, and also Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Finally, I spoke with President George W. Bush, who was very generous with his time, wishing me all the best. I asked about calling his father, for whom I had also worked, and he said it would be difficult at that time, so I simply asked that he pass on my regards. I had lunch with McMaster on March 27th in the Ward Room, part of the White House Navy mess facility. He was gracious and forthcoming in his assessments of issues, policies, and personnel. A few days later, I had breakfast with Jim Mattis at the Pentagon. Mattis showed his flair with the press as he greeted me at the entrance by saying he had heard I was the devil incarnate. I thought of replying, "I do my best," but bit my tongue. We had a very productive discussion. Mattis suggested that he, Pompeo, and I have breakfast once a week at the White House to go over pending issues. Although we were all on the telephone with each other several times most days, the breakfasts proved to be a very important opportunity for the three of us alone to discuss key issues. When one might be traveling, the other two would get together, usually in the Ward Room, but often at State or the Pentagon. When Mattis and I finished, he took me to meet Joe Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, whose term as chairman would last through September 2019. I recalled to Dunford his remarks on the North Korea nuclear issue at the summer 2018 Aspen Security Forum. He had said, "Many people have talked about the military options with words such as unimaginable. I would probably shift that slightly and say it would be horrific and it would be a loss of life unlike any we've experienced in our lifetime. And I mean anyone who's been alive since World War II has never seen a loss of life that could occur if there is a conflict on the Korean Peninsula. But as I've told my counterparts, both friend and foe, it is not unimaginable to have military options to respond to North Korea's nuclear capability. What is unimaginable to me is allowing the capability to allow nuclear weapons to land in Denver, Colorado. My job will be to develop military options to make sure that doesn't happen." Dunford seemed surprised I knew of his comments, and we had a good discussion. Dunford had a reputation as an outstanding military officer, and I had no reason to doubt that then or later. I broached Mattis's three-way breakfast idea with Mike Pompeo at the CIA a few days later. He readily agreed. He and I had already exchanged a number of emails, one from him saying, "I'm truly excited to get started as a co-founder of the War Cabinet. I will send Senator Paul your regards." I also had a chance to meet his deputy and likely successor, Gina Haspel. I had watched Trump closely during his nearly 15 months in office, and I had no illusions that I could change him. Any number of National Security Council models might have been academically sound, but would make no difference if they simply spun in a vacuum, disconnected, admiring themselves and lauded by the media, but not actually engaging the sitting president. I was determined to have a disciplined, thorough process, but I would judge my performance on how it actually shaped policy, not how outsiders compared it to prior administrations. Several decisions flowed from this analysis. First, the NSC staff, roughly 430 people when I arrived, 350 when I left, was not a think tank. Its product was not discussion groups and staff papers, but effective decision-making. The organization should be simple and direct. I planned to eliminate many duplicative, overlapping structures and staff. Since Trump had given me full hiring and firing authority, I acted quickly and decisively, among other things, naming only one deputy national security advisor instead of several to strengthen and simplify the National Security Council staff's effectiveness. This critical role I filled first with Mira Ricardel, a longtime defense expert with extensive government service and as a senior Boeing executive, and later with Dr. Charles Kupperman, a defense expert with similar credentials, including Boeing. They had strong personalities. They would need them. On the Saturday before Easter at 6:30 p.m., I had a somewhat bizarre conversation with Trump. He did almost all the talking, starting with, "Rex was terrible," and then explaining why, focusing on a decision to commit $200 million for Syrian reconstruction. Trump didn't like it. "I want to build up our country, not others." As a U.S. Agency for International Development alumnus, I supported using U.S. foreign assistance to advance national security objectives, but I also knew such efforts had their weaknesses as well as strengths. I tried to get a word in edgewise, but Trump rolled right along, saying periodically, "I know you get this." He then said, "You've got a lot of leakers down there. You can get rid of anybody you want," which I was already preparing to do. Finally, the conversation ended, and we both said, "Happy Easter." On Easter Monday, Trump called again. I asked, "How's the Easter egg roll going, Mr. President?" "Great," he said, as Sarah Sanders, her children, and others came in and out of the Oval and then returned to his Saturday night monologue, saying, "I want to get out of these horrible wars in the Middle East. We're killing ISIS for countries that are our enemies," which I took to mean Russia, Iran, and Assad's Syria. He said his advisors were divided into two categories, those who wanted to stay forever and those who wanted to stay for a while. By contrast, Trump said, "I don't want to stay at all. I don't like the Kurds. They ran from the Iraqis. They ran from the Turks. The only time they don't run is when we're bombing all around them with F-18s. He asked, "What should we do?" Figuring the Easter egg roll might not be the best time to discuss Middle East strategy, I said I was still waiting to get my temporary security clearance lined up. Pompeo, who had arrived in the Oval, said, "Give John and me a little bit of time," before he was cut off by more children and parents traipsing through. It was pretty clear Trump wanted to withdraw from Syria, and indeed, at an NSC meeting the next day, see Chapter 2, he voiced precisely these sentiments. Still, much remained to be decided, giving me confidence we could protect U.S. interests as the struggle to destroy the ISIS territorial caliphate neared a successful conclusion. On Friday, April 6th, heading into the weekend before my first official day, I met again with Kelly and several others to review West Wing procedures. I explained some of the NSC personnel changes I planned and the reorganizations I intended. I had Trump's authority to do these things, but I didn't mind informing Kelly in advance. He spent the rest of the meeting, which lasted an hour, explaining how Trump acted in meetings and on phone calls. "The president used very rough language," said Kelly, which was true. "And of course, he's entitled to do that." Also true. Trump despised both Bush presidents and their administrations, leading me to wonder if he had missed my almost 10 years of service in those presidencies. And Trump changed his mind constantly. I wondered, listening to all this, how close Kelly was to just walking away. Kelly concluded by saying graciously, "I'm glad you're here, John. The president hasn't had a national security advisor for the past year, and he needs one." I spent the weekend reading classified materials and otherwise preparing for April 9th. But as the next chapter will show, the Syria crisis came unannounced and unexpected, like much of the next 17 months. Acheson had written about Roosevelt's replacement of Cordell Hull as Secretary of State with Edward Stettinius, which had led the press to speculate that Roosevelt would continue to be his own Secretary of State. Acheson had a firm view. "The president cannot be Secretary of State. It is inherently impossible in the nature of both positions. What he can do, and often has done with unhappy results, is to prevent anyone else from being Secretary of State." Although not written about the National Security Advisor position, Acheson's insight was profound. Perhaps that is what Kelly was trying to say in his final comment to me before I started. And as Condi Rice said to me much later, Secretary of State is the best job in the government, and National Security Advisor is the hardest. I am sure she is right.